Welcome to Wicked Crime, a Massachusetts true crime podcast. In this episode, we'll be diving into Danny's murder and the details in the very beginning of the case. This episode talks about violence against children, and in later episodes, we'll be getting deeper into pedophilia and abuse within the Catholic Church, and so viewer discretion is advised. The last episode was mostly about, like, setting the scene, talking about abuse, vaguely touching upon some of the keen people, cast of characters, if you will, in this murder case. But now, let's get into what actually happened to Danny. On Saturday, April 15th, 1972, a man named Rafael Herrera went down to the Chicopee River at around 8 a.m. to go fishing. This was a spot that was located underneath what they considered the Governor Robinson Bridge. Now, I don't think it's even actually named that. There's a different bridge there that has, it's like the Veterans Memorial American Legion Bridge, something like that. And that wasn't there at the time. This spot was a known fishing location. People would go down there and go drinking. You could pull in your car right off the road. It's East Main Street in Chicopee. Or that section of it is East Main Street in Chicopee. And now there's a guardrail and you can't even get a car down there if you wanted to. But on this morning, Rafael goes down to go fishing and he goes to this exact spot that a lot of people are familiar with and he sees a body floating in the river. And obviously he calls the police and Chicopee Police Department comes down because it's their jurisdiction. And eventually the Hampden County DA's office sends the state police down as well. And this was pretty common to at least let the DA's office know, because if there's a murder, you're supposed to report it to them. But the weird thing about this case was they don't actually get involved unless it's like a high-profile murder or something very, very weird is going on. Not to say that like a 13-year-old boy being murdered isn't weird, but they didn't necessarily have to come down. And the minute they were there, the sheriffs, and the CPD was there, it turned into like a full chaotic situation. The thing was, no one got along. Everyone was fighting. The Chicopee Police Department was completely like distrustful of the state police, and the state police thought the Chicopee Department was like incompetent and they're all crooks. And so these two groups of men are buttonheads from the get-go. You had people stomping around the crime scene, so it was not handled very well. It's not like these are the most versed people in terms of crime scene investigation. It was also 1972. DNA wasn't a thing yet. They were just trying to gather evidence to try and figure out what might have happened to this poor kid. But the whole thing was bungled pretty much from the get-go. They had a Chicopee patrolman and a photographer try and like take a tire mold of the tire prints they had there, and they completely messed it up. They ended up with one sort of viable tire print. And all the evidence that was collected, it was collected by the state police. And what's really crazy in this case is that some of the evidence ends up going missing. One of the biggest pieces of evidence that goes missing is a bloody rock that was found with some hair on it that is thought to be the murder weapon. Because Danny, once they inspected the body, it looked like he had been bludgeoned to death. There was blood everywhere all over the crime scene. There was gum wrappers found, pieces of newspaper with some blood on them, a bloody straw, the tire print, other pieces of bloody rocks. So there wasn't like a ton of evidence, but there was enough. And even blood found that was not Danny's, that they later realized wasn't Danny's, was found. So they had something, but in terms of what they had scientifically back then, they didn't have a ton to go off of. I mean, this was a time that they would like compare hair follicles to try and match people to crimes, which is very similar. If you ever watched An Innocent Man by John Grisham on Netflix, it's all about how like these two men were convicted of a murder based on hair follicles, and later they were released and found innocent because the DNA was eventually tested and it was found that they weren't the ones that committed this crime. There's a theory that the reason why the DA got involved in this case was because a current at the time Hampden County DA was Maddie Ryan. And Maddie Ryan was a very good friend with Bishop Christopher Weldon. And he also had a reputation for hanging out with some of Springfield's mafia. He'd play racquetball with them. That's not really connected in this whole story, but it's something to note, I think. So he's friends with Christopher Weldon, the bishop at the time. And there's this theory that, like, maybe Weldon knew that Danny was murdered. And he called up Ryan and said, hey, you should get your guys down there. Something's going on. But I think if you assume that that was even possible, you're saying that the DA knew that Danny was murdered by a priest or the church had something to do with it. And, like, therefore, they look super guilty. And then with evidence coming up missing, they look even more guilty. And so I think saying that Ryan was part of this big cover-up is sort of far-fetched. But maybe he very well could be. And if he is, I don't even have words for that. But I think that that's sort of a hard thing to prove or to believe. Because later it comes out that Weldon gets accused of abuse. And two of the boys he was abusing were Ryan's nephews. So you'd think that if Ryan knew anything about this case, he wouldn't try to be covering up a murder on purpose. That being said, though, he is problematic throughout this whole thing, for sure. So they take Danny's body to a funeral home. Now, technically, a medical examiner should have been doing the autopsy for Danny, someone who was much more qualified. But instead, he ended up at a funeral home where it was like a mortician, and there was a pathologist from Boston who ended up there. So at least someone sort of versed in this sort of thing was there. But after doing his autopsy, they determined that the cause of death was blunt force trauma. He was beaten, he was dragged to the edge of the water, and then beaten again until he died. And actually, there was so much damage done to him, it looked like he was beaten after he was dead. That this was an attack that was pure rage-filled. Like, why do you have to keep beating on this kid after you know he's dead? It felt like to police that it was a rage-filled attack against this poor kid. And then not only that, but after they do his autopsy, they find that he had a 0.18% blood alcohol level. Which, for a 13-year-old kid, and I mean, Danny wasn't a small kid, but he was obviously very, very drunk when he was killed. He was also found to have a bunch of gum in his stomach, which is very important later in the story, but we will get to that. And they found the gum wrappers at the scene. Police also determined that it was a left-handed attacker because the wounds were on the right side of Danny's head, as if the person was facing him and hit him on the right side of his head, so it would probably be a left-handed attacker. But in the book Death of an Altar Boy, E.J. Fleming sort of says, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it was a left-handed attacker. He could have been attacked from behind. Two people could have been there. I mean, a whole group of people could have been there. Although I'm sure they may have found footprints that might have said that that wasn't the case, but maybe there were two people down there. That's one of those things that we might never know because this case still remains unsolved to this day. As I said before, some of the evidence that was collected at the scene, we had the bloody rock, which was said to be the murder weapon, a tire tread, which luckily they got somewhat of a molding from it, even though a photographer was the one who helped make it, a straw, gum wrappers, blood from whoever attacked Danny. Carpet fibers were on Danny's socks, a bloody rope, that was another one, a torn pocket off of Danny's shirt, more stones, some stained newspapers. I think this can also sort of lead into what could be another cover-up involving Ryan, possibly, as this evidence goes missing. Not all of it. The murder weapon goes missing. I don't know how evidence could go missing in a police case. I feel like, or you would hope, that this stuff is, like, better cared for. Like, oh, you know, here's, like, the evidence that someone committed a murder. Oh, it mysteriously disappeared. Which just sort of reminds me of, to go back to more Netflix shows here, Making a Murderer, with all this evidence seemed like it was tampered with. And it's easy to think, like, well, if evidence is getting tampered with or going missing, someone was probably behind it because it doesn't just walk away. And it's like, you have to remember at the time, Springfield was this Catholic city. The Hampden County DA was, like, in the pocket of the damn bishop. And maybe someone said, hey, can you make this evidence go away? This looks bad for us. I would hate to think that's the case, but you have to consider, like, all sides of it. Like, maybe someone purposely got rid of the murder weapon. I don't know why the murder weapon would be so damning, necessarily. I think you'd want to get rid of the evidence that had someone else's blood on it because it has someone else's blood on it. Like, granted, DNA, like I said, wasn't a thing at the time, but eventually it becomes that. But there's a lot of problems with the DNA, and we will get more into that later in the story. So initially, they say the time of death was said to be between 4:40 p.m. and 8:25 a.m. So that's from the last time Danny was spotted to when he was found, essentially. But then investigators kind of narrow it down to say it was between 8 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. There was even a local that said that he saw a car pull off by the murder scene and turn its headlights off at 7:30 p.m., which would sort of line up with the timeline. The way I see it as, I think whoever Danny was with, which, as we will get into more, police strongly believe he was with Father Richard Levine at the time. This person most likely got Danny very drunk. He, like I said, he had a 0.18 blood alcohol level. I think that maybe Danny was upset. He was throwing a fit of some kind, and they pulled off to the side down by the river, and maybe they had a conversation. Maybe they had an argument. Whatever it was led this person to attack Danny so violently that he was murdered. Whether this was on purpose or not, that we can't know. I don't think it was initially on purpose, but I do think that Danny had had enough of what was happening to him, and I think it led to whoever the person he was threatening, we'll say, to lash out and want to silence him, which they did in the worst way possible. Before he was found, Danny, his last known location is a little bit tricky because after a certain point, no one sees him. He'd been missing since the previous night, and one of the most horrible things to me is that his mother, Bunny Croteau, she calls the Springfield Police Department and tries to tell them, "Hey, my son's missing. Can we put out a missing persons report?" And they pull the old bullshit that, "Oh, we can't do anything until 12 hours have passed." Now, I have heard time and time again that this actually isn't true, especially with kids. I mean, I've heard plenty of cases where, oh, a little kid goes missing and they run out and try and find them immediately. Granted, Danny wasn't like a little kid, he was 13, but still young enough for there to be concern, I think, anyway. The SPD decides, oh, we're not even going to consider him a missing person, and they don't until 2:11 a.m., the morning he's found. I mean, it's this whole thing where, oh, if a person's missing, we don't really know they're missing until it's 12 hours. But the thing is, you know the people you know. So if you know someone and they go missing and that is completely not in their character, you have every right to be concerned. And the whole we have to wait thing isn't always true. If you ever find yourself in that situation, I would try and push it because you know who you know, and Bunny and Carl Croteau knew their son, and for him to just not show up and them not be able to locate where he was obviously not normal for him. So the Crotos, they tried looking for Danny, and the neighborhood kids and friends of Danny even tried to ride around looking for him on their bicycles. Obviously, this is a time before cell phones, so it wasn't like you could just call all these different people and they could immediately know where he was or wasn't. They did call Father Levine at the rectory. He said it was around 10 p.m. He said he didn't see Danny. It was not as common at that point, but Danny had been known to sleep over at the rectory with Father Levine. I mean, he very well could have been there with him. That's why Bunny called them. Also, Levine was their friend, and they wanted probably his help or guidance as to what was going on at this time. The previous day, on April 14th, he left school. He didn't take the bus. He hitchhiked with random people to get home to Ferncliff Ave, which is right near Western New England University. Eventually, he runs into his dad, who tells him to go and help his mother beat out a rug, which he does, and then he leaves to join a kickball game at around 4 p.m. Instead, he ends up joining his friend on a paper route until 4:30. Bunny thought he was going to a scouts meeting because he was part of the Boy Scouts, but the meeting was canceled and he didn't actually go. Instead, they say that he intended on going to a party, but that's where his whereabouts disappear. Some accounts put him in various places in the neighborhood, like, oh, near a pizza shop, or he's near the A&P. There is a person, Tom Cody, who said he believes to have seen Danny at the A&P around 7:30 p.m. And if that's the case, he was probably one of the last people to see Danny alive. And so it's also, you have to sort of note here that Danny has older friends that work at the A&P, which is like a supermarket. Three men, actually, who were significantly older than he was. There was Robert Fox, who had been seen before his shift ended at 4:30 to 5 o'clock that night. There was some man that drove a Ford Galaxy that gave Danny, quote, goodies, probably like dirty magazines. He'd been seen riding around with him before, and there was a man with that same description who had been said to be trying to pick up kids near Duggan School. And there was also a curly-haired hippie type, not my words, it's, you know, how the description was, who drove a VW bus and he was never identified. And these men were friends with Danny's scoutmaster, Ed Verano, who was another potential suspect. There were these handful of men that were involved, besides the older men that Danny knew from A&P, but like Ed Verano and these like few other Boy Scout related men who definitely should have been investigated, but they never were. We're going to talk more about them in the next episode. So we have these three guys from the A&P that Danny had hung around with before, older men. He was possibly there. That might have been the last known location he was at before he died, was murdered. You have these men who were part of the scouts that were friends with these men at the A&P. And all these people were very, very vaguely, or if not, some of them not at all, investigated. Because the police end up latching on so hard to Levine that they really don't look at anyone else. And that is sort of a mistake that happens with a lot of cases where they find a suspect and they become so incessant on making them their guy that they can't really see anyone else. And that sort of is not helpful in cases like this, because there could very well be other people who are involved or who are guilty, but like police kind of have this narrow view of things sometimes and they don't look at other people. And though Levine is like, he is pretty guilty in terms of like what happens after this whole murder, but do the police make a mistake in not looking deeper into other people? Yes. Why didn't Ryan push looking into other people? That's something that we'll never know. So after Danny is found, the police show up and they call the house first and they talk to Bunny and they say, we need to come, we need to talk to you. Make sure your husband comes home. So once Carl's home, the police show up and they tell him, you know, Danny's been in some trouble. And, you know, Carl thinks that, oh, what'd my kid do? What was he up to? But then they tell him that Danny was found murdered in the Chicopee River. And this is around 10:30 a.m. that they find out the news. Carl is escorted to the station, and on the way, they stop by St. Mary's to tell Levine, who offered to come along. The story goes that once they get down to identify the body, that it's Levine that does it. In Crash Berry's podcast, where he interviews Catherine Croteau, she says that this isn't true, but it is something that is always the story when you read about this case, is that Levine ID'd the body, Carl never got to see him, Buddy never got to see him, and we'll get more into that later as well. And so after this, the next day rolls around, and this is when Levine becomes the number one suspect, which obviously wasn't something he wanted to do. So Lieutenant Edmund Radwanski is one of the big police officers in this case from the Chicopee Police Department. He is at the scene the next day, and he sees Levine there, and he thinks maybe this priest is here to, like, bless the scene. Not uncommon. He was close with the Crotos, which Radwanski doesn't know at the time, but he doesn't think it's that weird until Levine goes up to him and starts asking these weird questions. Like, in such a popular hangout with so many cars and footprints, how can the prints you have be of any help? Or, even better, if a stone was used and thrown to the river, would the blood still be on it? Now, neither one of these things had been spoken about to anyone, like in the press or whatever. It's not like Levine would know that Danny was beaten with a stone to death. So why is he up there at the scene of the crime asking a police officer, hey, if I threw a rock at, well, if a rock was thrown in the river, would the blood still be on it? As if he wanted to know if evidence could get washed away in the water and would anything be able to get taken off of it in that case. And I mean, right then and there, if that doesn't sound guilty, I don't know what does. And then, on top of it, Levine refuses to give a blood sample because the blood at the scene was the same as his. It was B, it was a fairly rare blood type, and so he refuses to give his own blood. And of course, like, not that blood type is going to determine if you're a murderer or not. I mean, without DNA, it's just a blood type, but he was considered a suspect just because of that. Like, oh, he's left-handed. Well, we think the killer was left-handed. Oh, the blood type's the same. Well, he has the same blood type. So he gets sort of pinpointed immediately because of some of these things, but also showing up at the crime scene and asking all these weird questions. If he hadn't done that, you have to wonder, would police even have been looking at him for this the way they started to after this moment? So Radwanski realized that there was like this pattern of Danny sleeping over at Levine's, which got him even more suspicious when this high school male tells police that Levine abused him. He got him drunk at the rectory and fondled him. And so the name of this boy I could never find. Not that we need to ID this poor person that was abused all these years ago. But he was the sort of the first one that ever accused Levine of something, which was a big deal. But then Radwanski and detectives go and talk to the Croteau boys, the other boys, which is Carl Jr., Michael, Greg, and Joe. And they all said that Levine abused them, which was definitely news to Carl and Bunny, who, like, could not even believe that, because Levine was their friend, he was their priest. They were a very religious family. And so even, at, like, entertaining the thought that their friend had abused their kids was impossible. And I guess something that I don't understand from this moment is, why wasn't, like, Levine, why did he get in trouble for this back then? Because you have these five, really, if you count this high school kid, these four Croteau boys and this one other boy accuse this guy of abuse, and nothing happens to him. And I wonder if, is it because the Croteaus didn't press charges, that they really had no proof that he was abusing these kids? But it did sort of give them justification to think, well, Levine was probably abusing Danny too, if he was abusing his four brothers. But I do wonder that if maybe they had pushed more at this, if they had said, hey, this guy's abusing kids, maybe we should look into this, would it have saved more kids from being abused by him? I guess we can't know. And this also was a time before priests were ever publicly accused of this sort of thing. A priest had never been accused of murder before in, like, the country. This was one of the first times this was really happening. Not that he was ever formally accused, but he was certainly looked at hard after everything that happened. And one of the things that also made it suspicious was the location where Danny was found is right, like, a minute away from Eaton Street. And this was the home of Donald Charland, who was a friend with Levine. He was in the seminary with Levine. He hosted card games. Levine would go to them. Other priests would go to them. And it was alleged that they would bring boys to his house. His involvement in the abuse is unknown. He's not named in any of the big sex rings or cases. There's no cases really against him, but his house was right there. So it always made me wonder, was Danny at that house before he was killed? Like, did he get drunk there and then they drove down the street and they barely got down the street before Danny was freaking out and someone pulled off the road, possibly Levine, and this whole murder took place? Is this where the carpet fibers on Danny's socks were from? We don't know. They were never tested. And that's something else that really pisses me off, is you have these carpet fibers on these kids' socks. They're obviously from a house of some kind, and you never try and test them. There is a detective named R.C. Stevens who is a major, like, help in this case. He does a lot of great investigating, and his name comes up a lot in both Death of an Altar Boy and the Hell's Acres blog. He allegedly goes to Levine's old house where his parents lived, and he, like, pulls up the carpet in the basement, and it's a red shag carpet, which would match the carpet fibers found in Danny's socks. Doesn't mean anything. Not necessarily. I mean, those carpets could have been anywhere. But they should have tested those carpet fibers. And it's another one of those pieces of evidence that, like, isn't handled properly, which is, like, a lot of the evidence in this case. And the spot that he's murdered at is a well-known spot. He had gone there before fishing with Levine, so Levine was familiar with the crime scene, but many people were. It was a partying spot, a fishing spot, like I said in the beginning of this episode. It was known. I'm also going to get more into the suspects later on, because Levine, though he is a prime suspect in my mind, and like I said in the previous episode, everyone who knows about this case is convinced he did it. There are other people who could have been involved or should have been looked into more. Like I said, the older men that worked at the A&P, the men involved with the scouts, even other priests should have been looked into, because there's a priest named Alfred Graves who is accused of abuse. He's actually part of the Holy 13, which is an abusive priest ring in the area, and they would trade off boys to each other, but we're going to get more into that later. It's absolutely fucking awful, honestly, because even just imagining, like, a bunch of grown men trading off boys to abuse them is beyond my comprehension. But the rumor was that Danny, who had just turned 13, had been passed off to Alfred Graves, because Levine, it later comes out that he prefers younger boys, which is awful. You have to sort of wonder, was this pass-off to Alfred Graves part of the reason why this happened to Danny? obviously he probably didn't take it very well, because who would? And Fleming even says that too, is that maybe because Danny ended up being passed off to his other man, this was part of the reason why he got murdered, because he had threatened to tell before. I think it was really affecting him in his personal life. But why wasn't this guy looked into more? That's what really bothers me. And all these other men. The one person that they really shouldn't have been looking into was James Coleman, who was a local professor who would teach kids how to play chess. He wrote a book about the Circle Gang in Springfield. He taught boys wrestling. He was a good man, as far as I can tell. And I've talked to people in the area who knew him and said he was a great guy. He wasn't someone that I could see as a suspect. But, like, you're telling me you're not going to look at this guy who years later it comes out he was part of this abusive priest ring and possibly had an inappropriate relationship with Danny? Come on. So Danny, as a kid, he was like a joker. He was a good kid, but he did get into trouble, and I think he got into more trouble than his parents gave him credit for. He would get into fights at school, and, like, kids didn't want to mess with him because he was strong. He was a good fighter. But he liked to play pranks and goof off, and later Bunny would say that she wished that he'd still been around because he would have been the one, like, playing around and goofing off with the grandkids, which is completely heartbreaking. But it's important to know that he was sort of a fighter, because you know that he fought for his life when he was murdered at the edge of the river. And that's heartbreaking. Even as drunk as he probably was, he fought back. It ended up not mattering, because it was this poor 13-year-old kid against an adult. He took wrestling lessons from James Coleman, the professor. He also started hanging out with the Circle Gang. And they were this local gang in the area, the 16 Acres area, who they were just into getting into mischief. They did drugs and they drank alcohol and they would just cause trouble. They weren't the only gang like that in Springfield. There was a few of them peppered throughout the city of, like, groups of teenagers who just like to, like, screw around and, like, cause trouble. Danny's brother was sort of involved with them. They were punks. And Danny had been hanging out with them a little bit. But you later find out that a lot of these people in the Circle Gang had been abused by Levine, too. And a lot of them end up abusing drugs or alcohol or having these really horrible, like, adult lives. And even committing suicide. And a lot of it, I mean, yeah, they kind of grew up in this sort of rough and tumble way when they were in this gang. But, like, they were getting abused, too. And this isn't the only group of people that, like, struggle after being abused when they were kids. Like, other lives were ruined because of this, and that's what it just really kills me. And so Danny acting out isn't unheard of for abuse victims, so he's hanging out with, like, these tough kids. There were rumors of him having black masses, or he was involved in drug deals, even, like, that he was selling sex down behind the local newspaper, but I find some of this, like, hard to believe for a 13-year-old boy. His friends said that he always had money. And I wonder if that was part of keeping him silent. Like, were some of these priests, like Levine, was he giving Danny money? Like, hey, take this and shut up. Because I don't like to imagine Danny, like, selling himself as a kid downtown. Is it impossible? No. But that just breaks my fucking heart, even thinking about him doing that. Because, I mean, he's just a kid. But if he was being abused, then I think he was thrust into this, like, world that he was too young for, this, like, sexual world, and it makes people lash out in very, very strange ways. And Danny, he wasn't a dumb kid. He was smart and scrappy, and who knows what was really going on with him. Because his parents, I think, were oblivious to some of the stuff he was getting involved in, whether it be getting into fights or hanging out with, like, this rough group of kids. And obviously they had no idea of the abuse that was going on, but none of the parents didn't know. They didn't want to think about that. They didn't even want to consider it, because this was a man they considered a friend and a priest, which made it even more difficult to imagine. But I do wonder if maybe he was blackmailing some of these men, like, hey, if you don't give me money or you don't do this, I'm going to tell what's going on with you. And if this was blackmail, was murdering him a way to, like, finally shut him up, to get rid of the problem that was Danny? But the murder suggests that it wasn't just something that was planned, that it was very, like, rage-filled. It was an attack. I don't think it was premeditated. But the real question is who and why. What happened that night? Why did Danny have to lose his life? And if it was because he was being abused, then how fair is that? I mean, not that most murder is fair, because it's not. But I have a feeling that this case might never get solved, and I hope that that isn't what happens. I hope someday someone comes forward with a piece of evidence that gives us the answers that we're all looking for. So when they started looking at Levine, besides all those other things that, like, oh, the reports of him abusing boys or the weird questions he was asking at the scene, other things started happening that made him even look even more guilty. So his alibi was a problem. He would remember parts of his day on the 14th in great detail, like times and location, but then other parts he would have no idea. Now that, according to Fleming, is indicative of false alibi creation, where, like, as you try and make up a story, you give specific details about one part, but, like, are vague about other parts because you're trying to piece it all together in your mind. So he claimed that his parents could confirm where he was, but the thing was, his father was, like, out until 3 a.m. So his father really can't confirm shit in my head. And then he claimed to be doing errands with his mother until 8:30 p.m., but he couldn't give times for anything else. It's like he wanted to place himself at home at the time of the murder. So his alibi was sketchy, and then he started doing weird things after the murder, and it made police focus on him. We're gonna get more into detail about sort of his alibi and all that, but it definitely sounds like he was trying to make it seem like, oh, I was with my mother, she knows where I was. 8:30 p.m., I couldn't possibly have killed Danny. But the thing was, at one point, Bunny calls him at the rectory, so he wasn't home all night. He was out at St. Mary's at one point, and then eventually he comes home and goes to bed, or so he claims. And there's two things here. One, he had elderly parents. Did they really know what he was up to throughout any of this? Probably not. And two, your parents tend to love you, and maybe they were trying to protect him in some way or some fashion. Maybe they even realized they were protecting him. Maybe they're just kind of going along with it. But either way, he had an alibi, but to me, it's not a strong alibi because, one, it seems like you're lying about it, and two, it's your parents that are giving you your alibi. So can you really trust that? I don't think so. My parents would probably lie for me. Not that I'm gonna commit a crime anytime soon, but it doesn't add up to me. So then Levine ends up assisting with the funeral mass, which I absolutely hate. After the wake, he sort of distances himself from the family. After all this, he calls Bunny and tells her that, hey, I really shouldn't come around anymore. Which really upsets the Crotos because he was a friend and they didn't understand, like, why would you not want to come around anymore? That to me looks very guilty because if you didn't do any of this and your friends are suffering, their child just died, wouldn't you want to be there for them? But to all of a sudden decide, I'm going to wipe my hands of this and never talk to you again, that's not right. And maybe just because of all the buzz circling around this murder and how people, well, not people, the police, people didn't really know about it very much until later, but maybe all the buzz around it made him not want to be around them because he thought they would think he was a murderer. But Carl sort of later even says, like, well, if it was me, I would want to make sure that they knew I didn't do it. I would offer help. I wouldn't distance myself because distancing himself made it seem so strange, and it really killed the Crotos because they didn't suspect him at the time. They didn't want to lose their friend, and yet here he was at one of the hardest times in their lives, pulling back. And to make it even worse, Leo O'Neill, who ends up becoming a bishop in New Hampshire, I believe, he went to the Crotos and gave them $700 for a trip to California to see Bunny's sister, which was weird. Like, why are this church giving us all this money for a trip after our son's killed? And then after that, the church lawyer James Egan shows up and asks them, what do you think of this? Is there anything you want? And the Crotos were confused, like, why do we want anything? What are you getting at? And the lawyer pretty much goes, if you decide you need anything, let us know. So it's almost like the church is trying to bribe them to just not pursue any of this. Like, oh, if we're going to give you money and send you on a trip, we're just going to brush this whole thing under the rug. We're going to pretend your kid didn't die. We had nothing to do with it. Here's this. Let's move on. And it wasn't even like the Crotos were the ones pushing this whole thing yet. It was like the police that were looking into Levine. But to me, that looks even more guilty. Like, I'm just going to throw some money at you and ask if you need anything and make it sound like, you know, we're trying to butter you up in some way. I mean, I guess you could perceive this as they felt bad and were trying to help the Crotos sort of in the time of need, but it definitely comes out very weird. So now we have a murdered kid, Danny Croteau. We have a possible suspect, Father Richard Levine, which is, he's very problematic because it's 1972, he's a priest, we're in a Catholic city. it doesn't look good. We have this evidence, we have a murder location, but the police are never able to actually have a trial and fully have Lavina the suspect, which we're going to get into. We're going to get into all this and the suspects and what happens afterwards, and then go deeper and talk about how Lavina abused kids, how other priests abused kids, how this was a pandemic across not only the United States, but really the world. And Massachusetts sort of was the one that unearthed all of this when the Boston Globe started digging in deeper about priests and what was going on with them. And I like to hope that this isn't still happening, but I'm sure on some level it still is in places. And Danny was really just one of the poor victims that lost his life because of this. And I probably said in the last episode, I'm going to say it again, how many more Dannys were there? How many more kids had to die because they were being abused and couldn't take it anymore? And I guess one of the real questions is, who was really there that night? Who killed Danny? Who bludgeoned him? Who strangled him? Who threw him in the water and left him there? Who got away with murder of this poor kid? And maybe it wasn't Lavine. Maybe he was just part of some bigger thing. But I think when a whole city thinks this man is guilty, it means something. And the fact that a priest was not only abusing kids, but was possibly murdering them too, is beyond comprehension. And I can only hope that one day we find out the truth. So thank you for listening to the second episode of Wicked Crime. The music in this episode, my little theme song, is by Kevin MacLeod. Also, you can go on to my website, look at the blog, which is going to have pictures and stuff from the case, give a little more details, have some sources down there. Thank you, anyone who's listened so far. I do want to keep going with this, at least for Danny's case, and see how it goes. And next week, we're going to be talking more about the suspects and all stuff involving that and sort of what happened after the murder. And some of the weird evidence that also kind of comes up with Lavine, because it's not just we talked about here. There is more. There's a lot more. And I hope you enjoy this episode. Keep your eyes peeled. Keep looking. Keep researching. Always stay alert. All that good stuff. Thanks for listening. I'll see you in the next episode.